Chapter 12. Black Magic and Its Exposure. A small man, with a pear-shaped red nose, wearing a yellow bowler with holes, checked trousers and patent leather boots, rode out onto the varieties stage on an ordinary two-wheeled bicycle. To the sound of the foxtrot, he described a circle and then let out a triumphant yelp, causing the bicycle to rear up. Riding on the back wheel alone, the man flipped upside down, managed to screw off the front wheel on the go and send it off into the wings, and continued his journey on one wheel, pushing the pedals with his hands. A stout blonde emerged on a tall metal pole with a seat on top and a single wheel at the bottom. Wearing tights and a small skirt sprinkled with silver stars, and began to ride around in a circle. Whenever he encountered her, the little man would let out hoots of greeting and lift the bowler from his head with his foot. Finally, an 8-year-old kid with an aged face rolled out and began to dart between the adults on a tiny 2-wheeler fixed with a gigantic car horn. After several such loops, the entire crew rolled right up to the edge of the stage to an anxious drum roll from the orchestra. The spectators in the front row gasped and recoiled, for it seemed all three would crash into the orchestra pit along with their contraptions. But the bike stopped just as the front wheels were threatening to slip off into the void and onto the musicians' heads. With a loud cry of "Hup!" the cyclists hopped off the vehicles and bowed, the blonde blowing kisses to the audience and the kid playing a funny tune on his horn. Applause shook the building. Blue curtains moved in from the sides and covered the cyclists, green exit signs by the doors extinguished, and white spheres lit up like suns in the trapeze web under the dome of the roof. It was the intermission before the last segment. The only man who was not the least bit interested in the wonders of cycling technique exhibited by the Giuli family was Grigory Danilovich Rimsky. He sat in his office, in complete solitude, biting his thin lips, a spasm passing over his face every now and then. Likhodiev's incredible disappearance had been compounded by the completely unforeseen disappearance of the manager, Varyonika. Rimsky knew where the man had gone to, but he'd gone and never come back. Rimsky shrugged his shoulders and whispered to himself, "But what did they get him for?" And here is what was strange. Nothing would have been easier for a professional like the financial director than to call where Varyonika had gone to and find out what had happened to him. And yet until 10 o'clock in the evening, Rimsky could not force himself to do it. At 10, he practically bullied himself into taking the receiver off the hook and found out that the phone was dead. A messenger informed him that all the other phones in the building were malfunctioning. This unpleasant, but by no means supernatural occurrence, shocked the financial director finally and completely, but pleased him at the same time. There was no longer a need to call. When a red light lit up and began to blink over the financial director's head, informing him of the onset of intermission, a messenger walked in and told him that the foreign artist had arrived. The financial director shuddered for some reason and, growing darker than a storm cloud, went out to the wings to greet the visiting performer because there was no one else left to do it. Under various pretexts, curious folk peeked into the large dressing room from the corridor where signal bells were already ringing. There were magicians in bright robes and turbans, a skater in a knitted white jacket, a storyteller, his face white with powder, and the makeup man. The arriving celebrity stunned everybody with his wondrously cut, remarkably long tailcoat, and the fact that he wore a black half-mask. But most amazing of all were the black magician's two companions, a tall, checkered fellow in a cracked pince-nez, and a fat black cat, who, upon entering the dressing room on hind paws, sat down very casually on the couch and squinted at the unshielded makeup lights. Rimsky attempted to show a smile on his face, which had the effect of making him look mean and sour, and bowed to the silent magician sitting on the couch next to the cat. There was no handshake. However, the nonchalant checkered man personally introduced himself to the financial director as an assistant of theirs. This circumstance surprised the financial director, once again unpleasantly, for there was positively no mention of any assistance in the contract. Most uncomfortably and dryly, Grigory Danilovich inquired of the out-of-the-blue checkered man where the artist's equipment was. "Our heavenly diamond, most precious Sir Director," the magician's assistant replied in a rattling voice. "Our equipment is always with us. Here it is. Ein, zwei, drei." And, flicking his knotty fingers in front of Rimsky's eyes, he reached suddenly behind the cat's ear and pulled out Rimsky's own gold watch and chain, which had previously been in the financial director's waistcoat pocket, beneath a buttoned jacket, with the chain strung through a buttonhole. Rimsky clutched his stomach reflexively. All those present gasped, and the makeup man, looking through the door, grunted his approval. "Your watch, please accept," the checkered one said, smiling insolently, and handed the confused Rimsky his possession with a dirty hand. "Don't sit next to this one on a tram," the storyteller whispered quietly and cheerfully to the makeup man. But the cat pulled a stunt that put the stolen watch completely in the shade. Rising suddenly from the couch, he approached the dressing table on hind paws, removed the stopper from the carafe with his front, poured some water into a glass, drank it, replaced the stopper, and wiped his whiskers with a makeup cloth. This time, no one gasped. They merely stood with their mouths open, while the makeup man exclaimed in awe, "First rate!" The bells rang anxiously for the third time, and everyone piled out of the dressing room, excited and anticipating an interesting performance. A minute later, the spheres inside the theatre extinguished, the footlights lit up and cast a reddish glow on the bottom of the curtain, and in the illuminated gap between the curtain halves, there appeared before the audience a plump, clean-shaven fellow, gleeful as a child, his tailcoat crumpled and his shirt not quite fresh, well known to all of Moscow. It was the MC, George Bengalsky.
"And so, ladies and gentlemen,"
Bengalsky began with a babyish smile,
"you are about to see..."
Here, Bengalsky interrupted himself and spoke in a different tone. "I see the audience has grown even larger in time for the third segment. We got half the city here today. The other day, met a friend of mine, and I said to him, 'Why don't you ever come by? We had half the city over yesterday.' And he said, 'I live in the other half.'" Bengalsky paused, waiting for a burst of laughter. But as no one laughed, he continued.
"And so, you are about to see a famous foreign artist, Monsieur Volant, and his seance of black magic. Now, you and I certainly understand," here Bengalsky smiled a knowing smile, "that there's no such thing in the world, and that it's nothing more than superstition. Maestro Volant has simply achieved a higher mastery of various trick techniques, which will become evident in the most interesting part of the performance, or, more specifically, the exposure of these techniques. And since we're all eager for both the techniques and the exposure, let us welcome Sir Volant."
Having spewed all this drivel, Bengalsky clasped the palms of his hands together and waved them amicably at the gap in the curtain, causing the halves to slide apart with a quiet rustle. The magician's entrance, along with his tall assistant and the cat, who walked on stage on hind paws, delighted the audience greatly.
"An armchair for me," Volant ordered quietly,
and that very second, an armchair appeared on stage out of nowhere and by unknown means, and the magician sat in it.
"Tell me, dear Fagot,"
Volant inquired of the checkered hack, who evidently went by another name besides Kuroviov.
Tell me, would you say that Moscow's population has changed significantly?
The magician glanced at the silent audience, which was stunned by the armchair's appearance out of thin air.
Quite so, Messiah,
Fagot Kuroviov replied quietly.
You are right. The citizens have changed a lot, in their look, I mean. As did the city itself, though. The clothing goes without saying, but now there are all these, what do you call them? Trams, cars.
Buses,
Fagot prompted politely. The audience took in this conversation carefully, believing it to be a prelude to the magic. The wings were packed with actors and stagehands, Rimsky's tense, pale face among them. Bengalski's face began to express confusion as he huddled at the side of the stage. He raised his eyebrow ever so slightly, and, taking advantage of the pause, began,
"The foreign artist expresses his admiration for Moscow, which has grown in a technological sense, and also for the Muscovites."
Bengalski smiled twice, first at the orchestra and then at the gallery. Volant, Fagot, and the cat turned their heads in the MC's direction.
"Did I express admiration?"
the magician asked Fagot.
"Not at all, Messiah. You express nothing of the sort,"
the latter replied.
"So what is that man talking about?"
"Oh, he just lied,"
the checkered assistant loudly informed the entire theatre, and, turning to Bengalski, added,
"Allow me to congratulate you, mister. You just lied."
A light snigger came from the gallery, while Bengalski flinched and his eyes bulged.
"But of course, I am not so much interested in all these buses and telephones and other..."
"Gadgets,"
suggested the checkered man.
"Quite right, thank you."
The magician spoke slowly, in a heavy bass.
"What interests me is a far more important consideration. Have these citizens changed inside?"
"Yes, it is a most important question, sir."
Those in the wings began to exchange looks and shrug their shoulders. Bengalski was bright red, and Rimsky was pale. But then, as if sensing the brewing distress, the magician said,
"However, we have digressed, my dear Fagot, while the audience grows bored. Show us something simple to begin with."
The theatre shifted with relief. Fagot and the cat went to opposite sides of the stage. Fagot snapped his fingers and gave a boisterous cry of,
"A one! And a two!"
He took a deck of cards right out of the air, shuffled it, and sent it flying in a ribbon towards the cat. The cat intercepted the ribbon and sent it back. The satin serpent snorted. Fagot opened his mouth like a baby bird, and card after card swallowed it all. Following this, the cat bowed, shuffling his feet, and won tremendous applause.
"First rate! First rate!"
came rapturous shouts from the wings. Then Fagot jabbed his finger at the orchestra and announced,
"This deck, dear ladies and gentlemen, is now located in the seventh row in the pocket of Mr. Parchevsky, right between a three-ruble note and a court summons regarding alimony payments to Madame Zelkova."
The orchestra stirred, people began to rise, and finally, some man named precisely Parchevsky, all purple with amazement, extracted the deck from his wallet and began waving it around, unsure of what to do with it.
"Keep it as a memento,"
Fagot cried.
"No wonder you said at dinner last night that, were it not for poker, your life in Moscow would be completely unbearable."
"Old hat,"
came from the gallery.
The one in the orchestra is part of the same gang. You think so?
Fagot bellowed, squinting at the gallery.
In that case, you're part of the gang too, because now it's in your pocket.
There was movement in the gallery, and a happy voice said,
True! He's got it! It's here! It's here! Wait! But these are tens!
Those sitting in the orchestra turned their heads. Some confused gentleman in the gallery found a stack of notes in his pocket, wrapped by the bank and labelled 1,000 rubles. His neighbours pressed around him as he picked at the wrapper with his fingernail in astonishment, trying to find out if the tens were real or some sort of magic ones.
By God, they're real tens!
People screamed happily from the gallery.
I wouldn't mind a game with that sort of deck,
a fat man in the middle of the orchestra requested cheerfully.
Avec plaisir,
Fagot replied.
But why you alone? Everyone can join in,
he commanded.
I ask you to please look up. One.
A pistol appeared in his hand, and he shouted.
Two.
The pistol rose up in the air. He shouted.
Three.
And there was a flash, a crash, and white pieces of paper instantly began to fall from under the dome of the theatre, weaving between the trapezes. They whirled around. They were blown all over. They crowded above the gallery and drifted over the orchestra pit and the stage. In a few seconds, growing thicker and thicker, the money rain reached the seats, and the spectators began to catch the pieces of paper. Hundreds of arms rose up. Spectators held the notes to the light coming from the stage and beheld authentic, honest-to-God watermarks. The smell also left little doubt, incomparable in its pleasantness. It was the smell of freshly printed money. First joy, then awe, took over the whole theatre. The words, tens, tens, buzzed everywhere, amid exclamations of, oh, oh, and joyful laughter. Some were already crawling around in the aisle, rummaging under the seats. Many stood on the seats, catching the whirly, unpredictable banknotes. The faces of the policemen on duty gradually became puzzled, while the actors began to peek out unceremoniously from the wings. A voice came from the dress circle.
What are you grabbing at? It's mine. It was flying towards me.
And then another.
Stop shoving or I'll give you a good shove myself.
Then came the sound of a slap. A policeman's helmet appeared immediately in the dress circle. Someone from the dress circle was led out. The general excitement grew, and no one knows what all of this would have led to had Fagot not stopped the money rain by blowing suddenly into the air. Exchanging meaningful, happy looks, two young men rose from their seats and made straight for the bar. A din persisted in the theatre. The eyes of all the spectators glittered with excitement. Yes, yes, no one knows what all of this would have led to, had Bengelsky not found the strength to move. Trying to compose himself, he rubbed his hands habitually and began in his most resonant voice.
Here, ladies and gentlemen, we have just seen an instance of so-called mass hypnosis, a simple scientific demonstration best serving to show that miracles and magic do not exist. Let us ask Maestro Volant to expose this demonstration. You will now see, folks, how these alleged monetary notes disappear just as suddenly as they appeared.
He began to applaud, quite alone, with a confident smile playing on his face. There was absolutely no confidence in his eyes, however, but instead something more like a plea. The audience did not like Bengalski's speech. Complete silence fell, and then was interrupted by the checkered Fagot.
This is again an instance of so-called fibbing,
he announced in a loud, goatish tenor.
The bills are genuine, folks.
Bravo!
A low voice barked abruptly somewhere above.
By the way, This one here,
Fagot pointed at Bengalski,
is getting on my nerves. Always sticking his nose where no one's asking him to. Disrupting the seance with false commentary. What should we do with him?
Rip his head off,
someone said sternly in the gallery.
What did you say, huh?
Fagot responded instantly to the crude suggestion.
Rip his head off? Now there's an idea, Behemoth.
He yelled to the cat.
Do it! Ein, zwei, drei!
And then a remarkable thing happened. The black cat's fur stood on end, and he gave a shrill meow. Compressing himself into a ball, he leapt straight onto Bengalski's chest like a panther, and then climbed onto his head. Grunting, the cat sank his plump paws into the MC's thinning hair, and with a savage howl, twisted the head off its fat neck in two turns. 2,500 people in the theatre joined voices in a single scream. Fountains of blood surged from the severed arteries of the neck and spilled onto the tailcoat and shirt front. The headless body picked up its feet awkwardly and sat down on the floor. Hysterical women's cries came from the audience. The cat handed the head to Fagot, who lifted it by the hair and showed it to the public. And this head screamed desperately at the entire theatre.
Call a doctor! Are you going to spew any more nonsense in the future?
Fagot asked the weeping head menacingly.
I won't,
croaked the head.
For God's sake, don't torture him!
A woman's voice came suddenly from a box seat, rising over the clamour. And the magician turned his head in the direction of this voice.
So how about it, folks? Shall we forgive him?
Fagot asked of the audience.
Forgive him! Forgive him!
Came scattered and mostly women's voices at first, and then merged in chorus with the men's.
What are your orders, Messiah?
Fagot asked the masked man.
Well, the latter replied pensively. People are people. They like money. But then again, they always did. Mankind loves money, whether made of leather, paper, bronze, or gold. So they're thoughtless. Well, what of it? And mercy knocks at their heart's door sometimes. Ordinary people, reminiscent of the old ones, generally. Only the housing problem has corrupted them.
And he ordered loudly,
put the head back on.
Taking careful aim, the cat slapped the head on the neck, and it fell precisely into place as if it had never left. Moreover, not even a scar remained. The cat brushed over Bengalski's tailcoat and shirt front with his paws, and the bloodstains disappeared. Fagot lifted the sitting Bengalski to his feet, shoved a wad of tens in his tailcoat pocket, and led him off stage with the words,
get lost! More fun without you!
Looking round senselessly and staggering, the MC only managed to reach the fire station before he became unwell.
My head! My head!
He cried out miserably. Rimsky and the others dashed towards him. The MC wept, grasped for something in the air with his hands, and muttered,
give me back my head. Give it back. Take the apartment. Take the paintings. Just give me back my head.
A messenger ran for a doctor. The rest attempted to lay Bengalski down on a couch in the dressing room, but he began to struggle and became unruly. An ambulance had to be called. After the unfortunate MC had been taken away, Rimsky ran back to the stage and beheld new wonders. By the way, perhaps it was at that time, or a little earlier, but the magician disappeared from the stage along with his faded armchair. However, The audience did not notice this at all, distracted by the extraordinary things unfolding on stage, courtesy of Fagot. Having dispatched the injured MC, Fagot said this to the audience.
Now that we've sent the pest packing, let's open up a ladies' boutique.
Instantly, the stage floor was covered in Persian rugs. Giant mirrors sprang up, lit from the sides by green tubes, and between the mirrors, the happily astonished audience beheld display windows full of Parisian women's dresses of various cuts and colours. These appeared in some of the displays, while others showed off hundreds of hats, with feathers and lacking feathers, with buckles and without, and hundreds of shoes, black, white, yellow, leather, satin, suede, with straps, with gems. Perfume cases materialised among the shoes, the shiny facets of the crystal bottles playing in the light. There were mountains of handbags made of antelope hide, suede and silk, and amid these lay whole piles of little elongated golden cylinders, such as usually contain lipstick. Hell knows where from, a red-headed girl in a black evening gown popped up near the displays and smiled a proprietor's smile. A fine girl in all respects. Were she not marred by an odd scar on her neck? Grinning sweetly, Fagot declared that his firm would provide absolutely free exchanges of old ladies' dresses and footwear for the latest Parisian models and Parisian footwear. He added that the same went for the handbags, the perfume, and the rest. The cat began to shuffle his rear paw, while using his front to make gestures that became a doorman opening a door. A little hoarsely, but sweetly nonetheless, the girl began to drawlingly sing out something cryptic and, judging by the faces of the women in the orchestra, very tantalising. Guerlain, Chanel No. 5, Mitzo au cul, Narcisse noir, evening gowns, cocktail dresses. Fagot weaved around. The cat bowed. The girl opened up the display windows.
Please, Fagot bellowed. No embarrassment, no formalities.
The audience was excited, but no one yet dared to go on stage. Finally, some brunette stepped out of the 10th row of the orchestra and, smiling as if to say that, you know, it was all the same to her and she positively did not give a damn, went up the side ramp to the stage.
Bravo!
Fagot exclaimed.
Welcome to our first customer. Behemoth, a chair. Let's begin with the shoes, madam.
The brunette sat down on the chair and Fagot poured out a whole heap of shoes on the carpet before her. The brunette took off her right shoe and tried on a new lilac one. She stamped her foot on the carpet and looked over the heel. They won't pinch, will they? She asked pensively.
Come now, come now,
a hurt Fagot exclaimed, while the cat meowed resentfully.
I'll take this pair, monsieur,
the brunette said with dignity, putting on the second shoe. The brunette's old shoes were tossed behind a curtain, where she herself followed, accompanied by the red-headed girl and Fagot, the latter carrying several fashionable dresses on hangers. The cat fussed about and helped, draping measuring tape over his neck for added appearance. A minute later, the brunette emerged from behind the curtain in a dress that made the entire orchestra gasp. Rendered remarkably prettier, the brave woman stopped by the mirror, wriggled her bare shoulders, touched her hair around the nape of her neck, and contorted, trying to get a look at her back.
The company asks you to accept a souvenir,
Fagot said, handing her an open perfume case with a bottle inside.
Merci,
the brunette said haughtily, and descended the ramp to the orchestra. As she walked, spectators leapt up to touch the perfume case. Then everything broke loose, and women came on stage from all directions. Amid the general excited clamour, sniggers and sighs, came a male voice,
I won't let you.
And a female one. You are a despot and a Philistine. Stop hurting my arm.
Women disappeared behind the curtain, left their dresses there, and emerged in new ones. An entire row of ladies sat upon gold-legged stools, energetically stamping their newly shod feet into the carpet. Fagot went down on his knees, manipulating a shoehorn. The cat, swooning under piles of handbags and shoes, dragged himself from the displays to the stools and back again. The girl with the mangled neck appeared and disappeared, reaching the point where she prattled on solely in French. Most surprisingly, all the women managed to understand her every word, including those who did not know the slightest bit of the French language. To everyone's amazement, a man squeezed into the crowd on stage. He announced that his wife had the flu and that he would like to accept something on her behalf. To prove that he was actually married, the man was willing to present his passport. The caring husband's statement was met with laughter. Fagot yelled that he believed him like he believed his own self and handed the man two pairs of silk stockings, while the cat added a small lipstick case from himself. The latecomers ripped onto the stage, while the lucky ones poured off it dressed in ballroom gowns, pyjamas with ornate dragons, serious business suits, hats tipped over one eyebrow. Then Fagot announced that due to the late hour, the store would close until the next evening in exactly 1 minute. And unbelievable turmoil ensued on stage. Women grabbed hastily at shoes without any attempt to try them on. One of them burst behind the curtain in a storm, threw off her suit, and took possession of the first item that came to hand, a silk robe covered in gigantic flowers, while also managing to snatch up two perfume cases. Exactly 1 minute later, a pistol shot rang out, the mirrors disappeared, the displays and the stools fell through the floor, and the rugs dissolved in thin air, along with the curtain. The tall mountain of old dresses and shoes was the last to disappear, and the stage again became sombre, empty, and bare. And then a new character got involved. A pleasant, loud, and very insistent baritone came from box number two.
"It would nonetheless be desirable, Mr. Artist, if you would reveal to the spectators the techniques behind your tricks without delay, particularly the one with the paper money. The MC's return to the stage is equally desirable. The audience is worried about his fate."
The baritone belonged to none other than the evening's guest of honour, Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov, chairman of the Acoustics Commission of Moscow Theatres. Arkady Apollonovich was situated in a box with two ladies, one middle-aged, dressed fashionably and expensively, and the other young and pretty, dressed more plainly. The first of these, as was soon afterwards determined at the drafting of the police report, was Arkady Apollonovich's wife, and the second, a distant relative of his, an aspiring actress with promise, who had come from Saratov and taken residence in the apartment belonging to Arkady Apollonovich and his wife.
"Pardon?" Fagot replied. "Forgive me, but there's nothing to reveal here. Everything's clear."
"No, excuse me. An exposure is absolutely necessary. Without it, your spectacular numbers will leave a daunting impression. The masses demand an explanation."
"The masses?" the impudent hack interrupted. "Did not appear to be demanding anything last time I checked. But, taking into account your most respectable wishes, Arkady Apollonovich, I'll have it your way. Perform an exposure. But for this purpose, would you permit one more tiny little number?"
"Why not?" Arkady Apollonovich replied patronizingly. "But it must have an exposure."
"Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So then, allow me to ask you where you were last night, Arkady Apollonovich."
At this inappropriate, perhaps even rude question, Arkady Apollonovich's face changed, and quite significantly.
Last night, Arkady Apollonovich was at a meeting of the Acoustics Commission.
Arkady Apollonovich's wife declared very haughtily.
But I do not understand how this relates to the magic.
Oui, madame. Naturally, you do not understand,
Fagot agreed.
You are quite mistaken about the meeting. Having left for the aforementioned meeting, which, in passing, was not even scheduled for yesterday, Arkady Apollonovich dismissed his driver by the building of the Acoustics Commission on the Pristine Ponds.
The entire theatre fell silent.
Then took the bus to Yelohovskaya Street to visit an actress of the regional travelling theatre, Militsa Andreevna Pokopatko, and spent about 4 hours there.
Oi, someone exclaimed miserably in the absolute silence. As for Arkady Apollonovich's young relative, she suddenly burst out in a low, frightening laughter.
It's all clear now, she exclaimed. I've long suspected it. Now I can see why that untalented ham got the part of Louisa.
And, taking a sudden swing with her short, thick, violet umbrella, she smacked Arkady Apollonovich on the head. The conniving Fagot, also Kuroviov, cried.
This, dear ladies and gentlemen, is one example of exposure that Arkady Apollonovich so doggedly demanded.
How dare you lay a hand on Arkady Apollonovich, you strumpet!
Arkady Apollonovich's wife asked menacingly, rising in the box to all of her gargantuan height. A short second bout of satanic laughter seized the young relative.
Who else dares, she replied, chortling, if not me?
And for the second time there came the dry crack of the umbrella as it bounced off Arkady Apollonovich's head.
Police! Seize her!
Sempelyarov's wife shouted in a voice so terrible that many felt a chill in their hearts. And then the cat leapt out to the footlights and barked suddenly in a human voice for the whole theatre to hear.
The seance is over! Maestro, a march!
Scarcely aware of his own actions, the crazed conductor waved his baton, and the orchestra did not start to play, nor even strike up, nor even slam into, but precisely in tune with the cat's repugnant expression, scraped out an unbelievable, exceptionally shameless march. For a split second, it brought on memories of a café chantant under the southern stars, where the incomprehensible, half-blind, but rowdy lyrics to this march might have once been heard. His Excellency had a thing for cute domestic birds, but also took under his wing a few attractive skirts. Or perhaps these lyrics never existed. Perhaps there were others to the same music, some far more indecent ones. It's not important. What's important is that afterwards, it was as if the Tower of Babel had collapsed in the variety. The police ran to the Sempelyarov's box, the curious went climbing over the barriers, and hellish bursts of laughter, interspersed with feral cries, came from all directions, drowned out only by the golden clash of cymbals in the orchestra. And one could see that the stage emptied suddenly, and that the swindler Fagot, along with the shameless cat Behemoth, vanished into thin air, disappearing just as the magician and his faded armchair did earlier.